really great pleasure to be greeting you all. I'm going to begin in a moment with a very brief guided visualization, just so that we can let go of what, depending on where around the world you've been, has been a long day, even where most of us are, it's the end of the day. So allow me to ask you to just tuck yourselves back in your chairs, get yourself settled in, and take a really conscious breath in and let out an exaggerated, even dramatized sigh. Really go for it. No one can hear, so go on. And as you do, let your eyes gently close and let your breathing find its own natural rhythm. And with each out-breath, let go of any stress you may be holding in your body, so let your shoulders drop. And scan your body, your full height from the tips of your toes all the way up to the top of your head, your depth from perhaps the tip of your nose all the way back to your shoulder blades, your width from elbow to elbow, shoulder to shoulder. Become a really alert to your body, awake to your body. And put your arms physically around your body and give yourself some loving appreciation. Give yourself a hug. And as you hug, just notice the rising and falling, expansion, subsiding of your chest and your tummy with each breath. Like a tide. And with each in-breath in your own time, notice your heart there in your chest. And as your chest expands, imagine your heart expanding too. And as it does, as it grows a little bit bigger with each breath, let some of the armor plates that we feel we need to place to protect our hearts, let them expand a little bit and allow a little crack of light in and a little bit more of your own light and love out, so that you're still safe and sound. Don't have to be totally without protection, but just a little bit more. Letting your own love and light out, and the love and light of this extraordinary group, over 200 of us, getting on for 10 Hoffman processes, a population of 10 Hoffman processes all around the world. Knowing as you breathe into the confidentiality that we've all agreed to, that there is real safety in that, and also just the knowledge that someone else has done the Hoffman process is perhaps enough to know that we've shared, no matter what else we may or may not have in common, we've shared a really major life experience together. So we are, in some senses, in a little family, big family. So find your own place in that. Welcome yourself to the table, as it were. This is a big gathering of people, but you have your absolute place in it. That place is warmly welcomed. And it's only for you now to accept that place an honoured place with a good bunch. And lastly, just noticing how you're feeling emotionally. And as we always say in Hoffman Events, resisting, please, the temptation to judge the feeling as either good or bad. Don't fall into the trap of evaluating it as either good or bad, but instead just welcome the feeling as fully as possible. And it may be even more than one feeling. Welcome it. Full breadth and range of your emotional reality right now at this moment as we begin some compassionate inquiry together, some kind and loving exploration. So on that basis, take another breath in, let it go. Adjust your eyes to the light in your room. And once again, receive my welcome, receive all our welcome. All righty, so a webinar on the subject of tools in relationships. So you all know what tools are, the things we can do, just as we learned tools on the Hoffman process, where we'll be taking those and others to the benefit, to advantage us, to support us. In the comparatively reckless endeavor of having a long-term committed relationship, it's essential in some ways. There are some people who choose lives of solitude and seem to do well with them, and I wish them well with them. But as the proverbial hermit once said, when asked, "Doesn't it get lonely in your cave?" He said, "Sure, the path of solitude is certainly lonely, but the path of marriage, are you crazy?" So yeah, it is kind of reckless, isn't it? We take on something. I want to set a scene. This applies to long-term committed relationships. It doesn't necessarily apply to all relationships, but if we're going to do something like get together with someone and commit to them for the long term and live with them, and take on shared responsibilities, whether that be children, whether that be houses, whether that be working lives, or whether it just be the business of getting by, then one thing for sure is happening if we are dealing with human beings, assuming we're dealing with ordinary human beings. And the thing we can be sure of is that sometimes our togetherness, our relationship, will be meeting each other with one of us on final form, with the wind behind us, and in Hoffman terms, totally connected to our spiritual self. But the other one, under stress of some kind. That's one simple possibility. For the one who's doing well, bumping into the other one under stress will be painful, because what we innocently and naturally and lovingly want to give them may not be welcome. They may be, in their patterns, and unable to receive the love that you have on offer. That's painful. It's always painful to have what we have offered taken back or not accepted. Another possibility is that we might be the one under stress, and they might be the rather cheerful and, you know, hapless, you know, good-natured spiritual self who wants to love us. When we're in our patterns, when we are stressed out, we are often in shame, and in that state, it's very hard to receive love. There's something intensely painful about being on the receiving end of love that we can't naturally accept either. So these two dynamics, whatever they may play out as, whatever you may know them as in your life, will be guaranteed, because we're human and no humans never have patterns. Another dynamic is that both of us can be under stress. That means both of us will be in our patterns. That means both of us will be in some variation of shame, some shade of shame. And when we interact on those bases, that's when vindictiveness, and you'll remember that from the Hoffman process, that's when vindictiveness arises. Vindictiveness, you'll remember, is different to anger, because anger is warm and defensive, but vindictiveness is cold and punishing. When we are hurt, to put it very simply, when we feel hurt, what we sometimes do when we feel hurt enough is we feel entitled. And when we feel entitled, we act in ways, unconsciously very often, that we deeply regret and often feel quite bad about later. But in the moment, there's that vindictive energy that says, I'm going to make you feel what you made me feel. The words "you made me feel," by the way, I regard as amongst the most toxic in a relational conversation. "You made me feel" takes us immediately into victim. We're in child. It's a guarantee that we're in transference if we're using those words, because we're small and the other person's big if we're making them responsible for our feelings. So there's these three possibilities where what I'm going to call relationship contraction takes place. Other wisdom traditions talk about power struggle, but we all know what we mean. We're talking about that ding-dong that everybody knows when they have been in relationship beyond the initial romance. There is, of course, other moments, and I don't want to skate over them. I want to celebrate them, but briefly, because we're working on tools that help us get out of that ding-dong. There are times, of course, that really sustain us. There are times when both of us are in our spiritual selves and we come together, and those times are beautiful and perhaps more than that, deeply nourishing. They fill up the bucket, as some relationship people have called it, the bucket of love, meaning our resource, our battery gets charged up as a couple, and that can sometimes see us through. At least it helps to be able to drink from it when we remember the good times. So relationship contraction is the environment in which tools become needed and tools become helpful. I want to say once again, relationship contraction, power struggle, the ding-dong, is not a measure of having a bad relationship. And yet the world, with its obsession for romance, and a rather simplistic and unrealistic obsession that can often be as delightful as those songs and those novels and those plays and those poems all are, and the movies, as lovely as they all are, very often really they're just recreational escapism. But unless we really accept that human beings will go through that stuff, then we can fall into the trap of thinking, if we do go into that stuff, that maybe somehow I'm with the wrong person. Again, a very child-based thought. There is such a thing as compatibility. There's no doubt that not everybody could be well suited or happy in a long-term committed romance. That's obvious. But to quote Alain de Botton, who I heard speaking the other day, this is a lovely thing. He said that compatibility should not be seen as a prerequisite for a good relationship, so much as the outcome of a good relationship. You know, if we start to see compatibility as part of our job in relationship to create compatibility, and the Hoffman quadrinity model is excellent for this, we can ask ourselves, you know, with my partner, when they are feeling something, when they're feeling sad or excited or passionate or joyous or irritable or stressed or unhappy, can I get it? I may not be feeling it, but do I get it? Does it somehow make sense to me? And if so, that you can call that an emotional compatibility. We don't have to merge. We don't have to feel it as well. But if we can just put ourselves in this situation for long enough to just get it, yeah, okay, I can get that. That's your reality. Then that you can call that emotional compatibility. And that's where we make an effort to do that. That shows us that love is not just an emotion, it's a skill. And it's a skill that can be refined. So with that in mind, with those underpinning things in mind, I want to raise two other principles, all of which inform the work I've done over the years with couples. And I try to keep them alive in my own relationship life, in my own marriage. I can tell you quite happily that I am married for the second time. I was married at 21 and divorced in my early 40s and married again soon after that, and have been married since. So two long marriages. And I want to say, to introduce myself on that personal level, not just as a Hoffman teacher or a relationship coach or a group facilitator and all that, I want to say I'm absolutely using these tools in my relationship. And I absolutely know the ignominy of power struggle, of relationship contraction, of difficult times. In fact, if I'm addressing those of you who are in England, I've been in lockdown an additional week or so. And particularly this week, I'm starting to see some of the stressors in that. Talk more about that a bit later. So I introduced myself to you, not that there was any doubt about this, but I just want to be really clear, not as some guru, but as a fellow traveler in this wonderfully rewarding and also deeply vexing project of having long-term committed relationships. Okay, so power struggle, relationship contraction, ding dong. Yeah. What's going on in that situation? What's going on in the first instances of it in a relationship? That is to say, after the romantic love phase, what's going on in is the recovery from a rather altered state. Romantic love, at least endocrinally speaking, hormonally speaking, in terms of body chemistry, is an altered state. It's a high. It's a bit like taking drugs. I won't dwell on it because it's lovely and I wouldn't change it for the world. It's an enormous blessing and it charges up the batteries. But it's not sustainable in the sense that the projection of two people who've fallen in love is a little like the projection of a child and a parent. We set out a stall for each other, such as our intoxication and excitement that we found someone that we want who wants us. You can look up phenylethylamine if you're interested in doing the research. Google phenylethylamine, PEA. This is the hormone that floods our system when we're in love. And it creates this rather infantilized state. Commitment, I'm sorry to say, is the transition out of that. It seems to, when we do the research, seems to last about 2 years. It can be dragged on a little bit longer if we have a long-distance relationship. But once we make the commitment, once we get together, as I've said already, sooner or later, the stall that we set out for each other, which was responsive only to our perception of what the other wanted to see from us. It's not a lie. I don't want to suggest that we are lying or misrepresenting ourselves to our partners when we're in romantic love. Not at all. But what we are doing is we are partially or selectively representing ourselves. We're acutely sensitive to our partners. We sense what wins their approval and we show them more of it and we sense what puts them off slightly, and we hide it. Really what we're doing is we're hiding a back room. The stall is set out before us. Ta-da! My compassion, my kindness, my friendliness, my generosity, my faithfulness, my loyalty, my good humor, my forgiveness, all that stuff is on show. But my insecurity, my weakness, my dishonesty, my addictive impulses, etc., are well hidden. I don't want you to see them. I'm ashamed of them. Now, in the setting where we live with each other and we live with each other over the long term, as I've said, there'll be times when we're under stress. When we're under stress, that's visible. And when our partners see it, they'll feel betrayed. And when we see it in our partners, we'll feel betrayed. What happened to my knight in shining armor? What happened to my perfect partner? What happened to my idealized partner? Okay. The other thing that happens is that we, if we are exposed in that, we feel ashamed. So this mixture of shame and betrayal is what feeds that power struggle phase. What makes a good relationship is not having power struggle. It's getting through it quickly. Another thing to bear in mind is that it's through getting through power struggle and getting through it well and handling it well that our sense of intimacy deepens. Okay. So what are the kind of things that go on in power struggle? Well, it's a mixture of things. In the early stages of a relationship, when power struggle comes along, the impulse is to win back our partners. And the way we go about it very often is to try to give them even more of what they seem to love back in the romantic love phase. So we give it. And it's a very sweet and innocent kind of manipulation, but it is fundamentally a manipulation. It's not the authentic giving that we gave in the romantic love phase. That was giving, which was its own reward. This giving has a kind of an agenda. So I'm giving to you. Yes, I'm definitely giving to you. And on paper, this looks good. But it's got a little bit of an edge to it. I'm giving to you so that you now meet my need in some way. It's lost its innocence. It's lost its authenticity. And as anyone knows, when we are on the receiving end of that kind of slightly manipulative giving, we don't feel the reward of it. We don't feel nourished by it. So the setup for the giver is, look at me now. I gave you even more, and you're still da-da-da-da-da-da, not meeting my need. You're still not attending to me. So we go into victim. This is you can feel it beginning, can't you? The great vicious circle of power struggle. And you can also feel that the crucible in which vindictiveness really blossoms the stage is set because we're hurt. And also our partners are feeling hurt. Hang on a minute. They're also saying, hang on a minute. I gave you even more and still you're not meeting my needs. You're betraying the belief I invested in you as being the right person for me, or indeed the one who would be, in that rather infantile way, healing my wounds. So when it's got to that stage, very often there's a second stage, which is more overtly vindictive. If you're not going to respond to a carrot, we may have to bring in the stick, says the rather simple child thinking of the wounded party in a power struggle scenario. If you're not going to respond to my kindness, in fact, if you're going to abuse my kindness as we go into the victim thing, the little drama often attached to this, then maybe I shall have to punish you. Now, little of this is conscious, little bits of it may be fleetingly conscious, but none of us want to dwell on ourselves as punishing or unkind. So we airbrush our relationship with this reality, but it's worth being honest with ourselves. This is what can happen. If we feel hurt enough, we want to punish. And there are different personalities and different styles of punishment. There are two typical ones. One is, you could call it overt vindictiveness, open vindictiveness, direct. And it does have the virtue of being honest. Another style is covert vindictiveness, which has the slight virtue of being a little kinder, or seemingly. So the overt vindictive person will say, look, I'm just being honest. But really what they're doing is beating their partner to death with their honesty. And it will come out as criticism, blame, judgment, perhaps nagging, control, a kind of relentlessness. I won't let it go. Maybe a lack of ability to forgive or move on. And that kind of relentlessness drives one personality type to keep moving forward. I won't dwell on this too much, but I will say that personality type often experienced degrees of neglect in childhood. And the fear that's really driving them is the fear of abandonment, fear of rejection. So what they're doing by controlling and through anger and through criticism and blame is they're seizing the power in the relationship and they're forcing the relationship. You will not leave me. Even if we're in an angry state, at least we're in relationship. The covert style, often people who grew up with high degrees of control or bullying or restriction or smothering or high levels of expectation in childhood, what they do is much less overt, but it's the passive aggressive style. It's the yes dear style. It's the, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot. Did you say that? I didn't hear you. It's a much more passive style. They will praise themselves by saying, I'm so easygoing. I'm so, you know, I don't get upset. I don't create dramas. And no, they don't. But actually what they're doing is being evasive and often very victim-y. And so the two things, you know, it depends how you like your abuse. You could have it in sort of full Nazi uniform, or you could have it with a cuddly jumper. Both of it is, neither of it's very nice. You can decide which you prefer. So you can think of yourselves in this situation. You can recognize yourself. If you are currently in a relationship, of course, it might make sense to be on this call, but if you're not currently in a relationship, you're going to have to look back at old relationships that you've been in. Both of you are welcome on this call, of course. But think back for a moment. Think back, and what is your style? Are you an overtly vindictive pattern type, or are you a covert one? I definitely know I am the latter. If you do identify yourself, you probably, I can't say this for sure, but it's very probably the case that you are in relationship with someone who is your opposite. And that is, of course, because opposites attract, and what we are attracted to in people's qualities also brings with it a whole package with their patterns too. So we don't need to redo negative love syndrome right now. We are as attracted to people for their patterns as we are for their qualities. Not because the patterns are nice, but because they're familiar, and what's familiar is known. What's known is comfortable. And there we go. So here we are in power struggle. Now, power struggle has one other characteristic, which is that it's painful. And because it's painful, we soothe the pain. This is an addictive impulse, of course. Any attempt to soothe pain, it's often a misguided or a deluded attempt that brings short-term relief followed by a crash or a hangover as a kind of an addictive impulse. It doesn't have to involve drugs or alcohol or cigarettes or those things. It can be anything. Have a little think for yourself right now. What do you do when you're under stress that in the short term alleviates that stress, but in the long term robs you of being present or connected, and often may have a feeling of a hangover or a crash after it? So some of the things that we don't often include in that category, beyond the obvious drink and drugs and so on, include work. Work, and work in all its forms. So here we are in lockdown, and for some of you, that work may not be available to you. We will hope the situation passes quickly and you're back at work, as you may well want to be if that's the case. But at the same time, when a resource that is normally brings with it relief is taken away, you may be feeling the loss of work acutely, much more than the obvious reasons for being anxious about being out of work. It may be that you no longer have a space where you can take a bit of a breath from your relationship and claim an identity that's much more superficial and may involve some sort of status or role. And you can breathe out a little bit before you enter back into the fray of your sometimes complex relationship. It doesn't have to be work, it can be screens. And so whether we're in lockdown or not, screens are going to be perhaps even bigger part of life in lockdown. We're looking at them now, after all. But screens have been well studied, and screens alter our brain waves. And anyone knows that if you scroll too much in the Facebook zombie drool or whatever it is, whether it's Twitter or whether it's emails or whether it's just going on a little Google wild goose chase, one way or another, our brain waves are altered and we feel a experience of being disconnected, in a way anesthetized. And that can bring temporary relief. We may not even know or have been fully honest with ourselves about what these things are. Food, of course. Sex. Intrigue. Gossip. Drama. The things that we are using to escape stress can be also quite stressful. When we alter our body by getting stressed out, cortisol and adrenaline flood our system, that in a sense is a substance, not just a behavior. So we can get drawn into that. So there's this mixture of things. Inauthentic giving, as I said at the beginning. Then vindictiveness. When that's too painful, we need to escape. We create these unhealthy exits from the relationship, either through substances or behaviors. We may find ourselves in normal situations, unlike the one we're in now, finding reasons to go away, or if not to actually leave, to be on the phone or not present. Apologies to the current Mrs. Pruin and my historic romances for the number of times they've had to mention that I'm there but not there. So there's a capacity I learned in boarding school to space out. I learned it because I was fiercely homesick. And the way I managed that homesickness as a little boy was to look out the window and wait for the holidays, which meant that I learned very quickly that I could space out. I had this resource. I didn't need to take drugs. I didn't need to drink wine. I could just escape. And this has been the bane of people who have been in relationship with me's lives ever since. I shouldn't laugh. So you'll have your own version. What I'd like to do is, if it's okay with either you, Lucy, or you, Serena, could you unmute and we'll just hear a couple of people sharing. What are your escapes? What do you do when you're under stress in relationship? And how do you get away? How do you get out? How do you escape for a moment? And the next question would be, is that still possible right now under lockdown? So
just, I think the thing to do is to invite anyone who wishes to speak just to unmute themselves.
Okay, right. Thank you, Serena. Yeah, so anyone who would like to share, just unmute yourself. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, I will. Hi, Matthew.
Hello there.
Hi, how's it going?
Nice to see you.
I think I get obsessed with other people. I have a sort of like obsession thing that goes on.
Okay.
And it's definitely fantasy land. And yeah, it comes from childhood. I could really identify with you, you know, being in school, looking out the window.
I was just thinking that we might be a kindred spirit in that respect. So it's the escapism, yeah. Isn't it? It's a well-constructed little inner world that you can check out to.
Yeah, it's just another world. It's not reality at all. And I'll just try and keep it brief. So I am in a 12-step program, and that has really helped me to kind of come back to reality. And I have, if I catch myself in it, I actually just have a sentence that I say to myself, which is, Chanel, you're not in reality right now. And I can snap myself out, but it does happen. And yeah, sometimes I don't catch myself.
So you've got some support. You're very welcome. Thank you for sharing. Got some support and you've shared it. And I imagine it's something that you can still do even under lockdown. So it's readily available. Don't have to be outside these circumstances. Anyone else? Thank you very much, Chanel.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
So hi, I'm Navin.
Hello, Navin. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share that, you know, personal development is one of my sort of things that I go to and creating lists. So I just, you know, find things that I can do or read or see, or, you know, like this webinar, just trying to find things that I can do on my own. It could be, like I said, personal development, or just creating list after list after list of things that I can just do on my own.
Okay, well, that's a brilliant chair. Thank you very much. Because what it tells us is that the escape method doesn't have to be bad. You know, it's not, it's a wonderful, also closing your eyes and imagining something, as you've said, Chanel, it's hardly a crime. But what it does is it takes us out of a relationship. We can harness anything for that. Thank you, Navin. That's great. You could be escaping through meditation. You could be escaping through all sorts of quasi-spiritual avenues. And through that, we get a little bypass from reality, too. Now, what we know is that when we do that, is we come out of a relationship. And so the possibility for intimacy is absolutely lost. I've never looked the word intimacy up in the dictionary, but I've been using a working definition in my work for a long time. And the working definition I use is agenda-free, not gender, but agenda, A-G-E-N-D-A, free, sharing and witnessing. Agenda-free, sharing and witnessing. And what I mean by that is that the agenda that we can allow is that because I love you, dear partner, I would love you to be up to date with who I am right now. I'd like you to know how I'm feeling, what I'm thinking, and how I'm doing, my life experience. I want to keep you informed. I'd love you to witness me in that. I don't need your pity or praise. I don't need interruption. I certainly don't need blame, criticism, judgment. Don't need competition. There are a million things, of course, that get in the way and create an agenda. And it's very natural to get this wrong. It needs practicing. As I said before, love is not just an emotion. It's a skill that needs refining. And the skill of communicating without agenda is a big ask, but we can get a little bit better at it. Now, the sharing that I'm talking about could be agenda fueled, driven. What's an example of a communication that has an agenda? Well, I'm telling you how angry I am so that you feel guilty and pull your finger out and start meeting some of my needs. Now, I may not be saying that overtly, but that could be the driver. That would be an agenda, as I'm not just communicating to you to let you know how I'm doing. I'm communicating to you to manipulate you and goad you in this case. It can even be bullying or controlling. It can be much more passive than that. How are you doing? I'm fine, I suppose. I suppose I'm all right, really. Yeah, don't worry, I'll wash up. You know, that also has an agenda. It's a victim-y agenda, of course. Neither of those, I imagine, are quite as crass as what you are. They're much more crass and vulgar examples, extreme examples. But you'll know your modus operandi, and if you're honest with yourself, you can check in. You can say to yourself, "How is what is driving this communication? What's my intention?" And we can set intentions. We can't control others, but we can set intentions. And the intention that's behind all the tools that we're about to talk about now is to restore loving connection. That's the function of them, broadly speaking. So how to get out of the ding-dong, how to move from power struggle, relationship contraction, into expansion, into loving connection. Probably going to be the case to remember that if you are under stress, that's not the moment. We all know that, really. You didn't need me to tell you. But what you might not have known is that when we are in a stressed situation, which may or may not be overt, remember, might be looking all calm, but actually internalized, very anxious. But in those situations, we're dealing with also body chemistry changes and the cortisol that floods our system when we're in those anxious or angry states floods a system in under a second, and it takes about 25 minutes for it to pass through the system. And in brain science terms, that means it's going to be about half an hour before you're able to access qualities like reflectiveness, kindness, rationality, the ability to see more than one point of view, to come out of our own self-obsession. It's going to take about half an hour. So you're going to need a little trick with your buddy or partner. You're going to be able to have to do a little timeout sign, or say in the heat of the moment, something that gives your partner, you can agree this if you're with a partner tonight, you can agree a little sign. I think just for the sake of time saving, that's quite a good one. It's what the American basketball coaches do when they want to speak to the team in the middle of a game. They're allowed a few moments where they can check in. In this case, it's checking out. And the message that this means, dear partner, is I'm going to go away, but I love you. And I promise to come back. I promise to come back, and I promise to talk about it. But right now isn't the moment. Some personality types will find that very hard. Others will find it very easy. But the ones who find it easy, it's on you. The ones who go, oh, thank God I'm getting away. It's on you to make sure you really do come back. You really do talk on about it. So that's one thing to bear in mind. But when you are in the ready to talk about it, the slightly calmer state. Oh, and by the way, if you do cry, the cortisol leaves your system in about half the time. I think it takes about 12 to 14 minutes for the cortisol to leave your system if you have a good cry. So that's a good thing. We all know that from the expression stage of a Hoffman process. When we get a good emote, that means the burden we're carrying is much lighter. So the next thing is how to deal with it. The first step I would say is that there are tools that you can do to work on regardless of whether your partner wants to talk to you or whether the talking about it is on or off. There are certain things that you can do, work that you can do on your own. The first and most obvious thing as Hoffman graduates is you can do a quadrinity check-in. It may not have occurred to you that would have a place in your relational lives, but it is probably the most fundamental and simple tool that you can use. It's absolutely readily available, provided you're not in a stress, let yourself relax a little first. But then a simple and compassionate consultation with your own emotional self. If all you did was notice how old you are emotionally by closing your eyes and visualizing your own emotional self, and you just saw, oh, look, I'm 8. And then it might just be, oh, okay, have a little compassion for yourself. Have a little kindness, affection for the little child, the distressed little child that's under the skin of the grown-up adult you appear to be. And recognize that there's some old wounds there. But you can take it further than that. You can ask your own emotional child, what do you need? How are you feeling? You can set about trying to meet some of those needs for yourself. Take the heat off your partner. A quadrinity check-in. Give me the thumbs up if you all know what I mean by that. I'm going to assume you do. Thank you. Thank you. Thumbs up. All right. The next step is, you know, this really, the quadrinity check, it satisfies the awareness stage of the Hoffman cycle of transformation. It is immediately both self-forgiving and self-aware. And it also really supports a wonderful bit of Irish wisdom that I once came across. At least it was an Irish person who told me this expression, which is, if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. So for no other reason, I hate it and I love it, that expression. I still, in a childish way, still trying to fight it, but it is a very blunt reality that's unavoidable. If we do the same thing, if we react in the same way over and over again and expect a different outcome, then boy, are we kidding ourselves. So the awareness stage can be really satisfied. We can become aware of how we're feeling and what we need. The next step would be to express. Now, you'll remember the simple four steps of the Hoffman process. Awareness, expression, forgiveness, and then new behavior. So the new behavior, which is the Holy Grail, doesn't just come from awareness. Awareness, new behavior, no. Awareness, forgiveness, no. There was, I think, probably apocryphal Buddhist monk who did the Hoffman process. And this story has been passed down through many generations of Hoffman teachers. And the story goes that he said, after bashing for a couple of days on his process, he said, I've spent the last 21 years as an ordained Buddhist monk thinking I can go straight from awareness to forgiveness. This is good stuff, he said. For the first time, I'm finding the peace that I was trying to aspire to just by meditating, just by doing the soft stuff. No, the soft stuff comes much more naturally when we've had a bit of a bash. Now, it may not be possible, especially under lockdown with your partner, to discreetly pop into the other room with a baseball bat and a cushion. So I'm going to assume that that's not something you can do. If you can, it's tried and tested. Good luck to you. It's great. You know, and the other thing is you don't actually have to make that much noise bashing. You can get an awful lot of intensity into a whisper. You can really get it out of you, even if you're whispering. It really can be done. So if you can bash, great. If not, the one that has touched me most, more than anything else, as a tool of expression, of moving this stuff up and out, just lately, is dancing. And I haven't sort of said, right, I'm going to do some Hoffman expression. I'm going to, you know, leave me alone for a moment. I'm shuttering the windows. No, just in the course of the day, I might put on some music, might go over to our other space where we normally have, where we should be having large groups of people at the moment, and it's empty now, and put on some music and have a bit of a move. Now, if you're anything like me, you'll go through the same thing, which is even alone, the first experience I have dancing is a rather intense kind of self-consciousness. It's crazy, isn't it? There's no one there to judge, but I'm still sort of a little bit stiff and wooden. I find it's not necessarily rhythmic, dancey music that will support me most. So put on something schlocky, something that opens your heart, something that you might even be a little embarrassed would be a bit sentimental, and just allow your body to move. Let your body be in charge. Give your body the leader hat. Let your body lead you. It's full of wisdom. We flatter the vanity of our intellects to imagine that it's this bit up here that's clever, but our bodies are so much more sophisticated, so much wiser than our minds. So trust in your body. Another thing you could do is write a letter. Write a letter, be sure to burn it or delete it. But physically writing, handwriting, is also supremely expressive. We use it on the process. We don't say type out a text, an anger text. We say write the letter because it's got so much more that you can put into it. But shift it. Shift, express, externalize the vindictiveness. And you can focus on your partner if that is who is the object of your ire in this experience. If it's your partner who's driving you crazy, you can focus on them. But another thing that you can do, and this falls more into the forgiveness stage, so perhaps after a dance, perhaps after a bash, or write a letter, is that you can use the transference model. Now, I'm going to guide you through that, and this is going to involve you writing. So if you haven't already got pens and papers, now's the moment. Have your pen and paper ready. And then have it to hand so that in a moment when I've asked you to close your eyes, you can open and write and then close again. It'll be a little visualization I'm going to lead you through, some of which you'll spend with your eyes open writing and some of which you'll spend with your eyes closed. So start off by closing your eyes. And if you're with your partner sitting next to them, give them a little nod. Just a friendly hello, and then come back into yourself and close your eyes. What we know about transference is that it is not feedback. I'm going to say that again. Transference is not feedback. So transference is a tool of awareness. It's also a tool of compassion. Because when we can revisit the childhood origins of our frustration and suffering, then what we do is we take responsibility. We stop blaming and judging with quite such intensity. So it's an enormous kindness to ourselves and to our partners to actually write one out. That's what we're going to do now. In order to write one out, you're going to need to remember a stressful memory of you in relationship with your partner, or if you are not in relationship right now, you in relationship with an ex. Be just as useful in either way, because it's always good to let go of the past if we're still holding on to it. So take a moment, let that memory come to life. And remember that only our intellects can discern between what we call real and what we call imagined. Our emotional selves and our bodies respond to the imagined in just the same way. So even if it's a little distressing to go back into a memory, trust that this is leading you into the light, and trust that it's worth re-experiencing it as fully as you can. So trust yourself and allow yourself to feel the feelings that belong with that memory and think the thoughts that belong with that memory. And eyes closed is really useful because you can revisit the memory much more dynamically if you do. Now, in this memory, turn your attention on your partner. Look outward at them. How do you experience that person? How do you experience them? Is it that they are attacking, at least through the eyes of your anxious, stressed place? Do they seem like they're coming at you, attacking, judging, blaming, criticizing? Is it that kind of energy moving towards you in a threatening or aggressive way? It needn't be physical, of course. Is it a bit bitey? Is it coming at you? Or is it that they are moving away? You're feeling a sense of rejection or abandonment. Do you experience them as strong or dominant or weak or inept? Are you judging them as one thing or another? Don't worry if you are. It's very human. What story are you making up about them? Where does your dark side take you with this? What extremist or absolutist thinking are you going through? I always, you never. How do you see them? All right. Now, when you've got that clear, open your eyes, and on the blank sheet of paper in front of you, write the words, I had a negative reaction to you, and you can insert your partner's name right there. And then the when or where. Now, this is very important. It's just time and place. So last Wednesday in the kitchen, this morning in the bedroom, last week on the balcony, last year at that party, not when you did this or when you didn't do that. Forget the actions just now, just the time and place. Give me a thumbs up if you're there. Great. The next line you're writing is, I experienced you as, I experienced you as. And here's where you put, you'll remember this stuff, your perceptions, how you experienced that person. So I experienced you as judging me. I experienced you as blaming me. I experienced you as avoiding me. I experienced you as dishonest. I experienced you as manipulative. I experienced you as, you know, weak, strong, scary, aggressive, angry. You can also include anything that you heard them say. So I experienced you as weak and angry. I heard you say, you're wrong, you're stupid, I don't love you, you wash up. You can also put in, I saw you walk across the room without even saying hello. Experienced you as making a cup of coffee without asking me if I wanted one. So take a moment to capture some of those. I experienced you as. Now leave a space and then close your eyes again. Now revisit the scene. Bring it alive again as if it's now in your mind's eye. And from this time I'm asking you to look inwards. Instead of looking out at your partner, turn your attention inwards. How are you doing? What are you thinking? How are you feeling? And how are you reacting? What are you thinking? What are you feeling? What are you doing? Are you moving away? Are you moving towards? Are you trying to reclaim the relationship? Are you getting angry and biting? Or are you hiding away? What patterns are you going into? Judging? Criticizing, blaming, supplication, making yourself small, submissive, inauthentic pleasing, silently judging. Withholding. Denying your feelings. Fear. Wanting to run away, freezing, shutting down, getting overwhelmed, creating a drama. When you're ready, open your eyes and leave a space under I experienced you as, and then after that space, write the patterns I went into were. And then write, what did I think? What did I feel? What did I do? Now, from this place, when you're ready, revisit your experience of your partner, and in the space underneath, you write down, who was that like? I experienced you as angry, like my father. I experienced you as insecure, like my mother. It can be any combination, and it's not gender specific. It can experience you female partner, like my dad, or you male partner, like my mum. Both work. Surrogate parents, of course, can have their place in this too. Who was that like? Experienced you as judging me, like my mum. I experienced you as passive and shut down, like my dad. It might be that you look and you see, I can't attribute this to either parent. Neither parent were like that. That's strange. In which case, you can ask yourself, who was it very unlike? So I experienced you as obsessed with me, very unlike my absent father. I experienced you as not letting it go, very much unlike my passive mother. So like my or very unlike my. Next thing to turn your attention to, I hope I'm not rushing, is your own experience. So the patterns I went into, who did you learn them from? Underneath that column, write the words, which I learned from. Patterns I went into were inauthentic pleasing, which I learned from my dad, fear of authority, which I learned from my mum. If even as you write this, you've got a bit of an energy of resentment or anger, be sure to include that in your patterns. Pattern of vindictiveness or grudge holding or wanting to punish, which I learned from. It's fine that you have them. It's no crime. You're human. Forgive yourself. That's fine. But don't omit to own it. It's great to own this stuff. Now simply read from the beginning to the end silently to yourself. I had a negative reaction to you, partner, on that day. I experienced you as like my. Patterns I went into were which I learned from. Give me a bit of a wave if something's moving for you. If you, as you read it through yourself, something is shifting a little. Give me a bit of a sense of something. Yeah, thank you. A bit of a hands up, a bit of feedback. Thank you. So what's going on here is something that I know as someone who's facilitated groups to do transference models many, many times, is a certain thing happens when people write the first like my. And it's been a little hard to tell on the screen, but I can see this very clearly in the groups I work with, is that when it gets to the like my mother, father stage, I see people go like this. I don't know if you can see me on the screen, but they go, and then they go, oh. And their shoulders drop a little bit. And the toxicity of that sting of vindictiveness or pain or patterns just is released. So one thing we know about transference is that we can take 100% responsibility for our own stuff. We may never share it with our partner. Sometimes the impulse is there to do that. It is not necessary. If we take the attitude, this comes from another great bit of wisdom that anyone who's been involved as you were sharing earlier, Chanel, with any 12-step movement will know, the serenity prayer, dear God, or insert your own belief system here, dear higher power, please give me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Please give me the courage to change the things I can. And please give me the wisdom to know the difference. What a sane objective, what a sane mission that is. Wonderful. And in transference terms, one of the things we can't change, and this is such bad news, I always feel like I'm kicking a puppy when I say this, but one of the things we cannot change is other people. Of course not. There are 7 billion other people on the planet, and none of those other people have we any control over. There is only one person on this planet that we have control over, responsibility for. That's not them. One of the ways of discerning the things we can change is by looking inwardly. It's our own thoughts and feelings and actions. That's the bit we have control over. So transference gives us that wisdom that the Serenity Prayer asks us for. It gives us the wisdom to discern the difference. The bit in the first bit, the I experienced you as, that's just stuff. The bit in the patterns I went into, that's the richness. That's where we can start to get to work. And we'll use a tool before we finish. We will use a tool. We'll recycle one of those patterns. So right now, draw a circle around the biggest pattern that, if nothing else changed as a result of the work that we do tonight in this webinar, that would be the juiciest one. And if you feel inspired, unmute your mic and shout out the pattern and who you learned it from.
Mentally running away.
Learned from?
Both of them, I think.
Bit of both. Thank you, Alison. Anyone else?
Playing games.
Sorry, who was that?
Patrick, playing games.
Shall I learn from Mum? Playing games, learn from Mum. Go on, a couple more.
Yeah, fulfilling other people's needs at my expense.
Thank you, Amanda. Any more?
Feeling powerless.
Feeling powerless. Keep coming.
I can't say anything.
Sorry, let's hear that last one again.
Feeling like I can't say anything.
Thank you, Philip.
Shutting down.
Shutting down. Okay, sister there, totally recognized that one myself.
Silence.
Being defensive.
Good stuff. Okay. So mute yourselves again, and sorry if you didn't get a chance to share. So we're going to work with that pattern. But before I do, I just want to say, there are some really elegant ways of getting out of power struggle. And what we need is the quality of humility. We've been fed a bit of a lie about relationships. And the lie that we've been fed is that a good relationship is, first of all, the lie has been that a good relationship never goes into this power struggle phase. And if you're in it, then you're with the wrong person. Absolute, excuse my French, bullshit. That's just not it. Now, the second lie is that we've been told that good relationship is 50-50. Well, of course it takes people to share and stuff. But actually, to get out of power struggle, 50-50 is also not true. 100-100 is a really rich attitude to bring into this situation. And it brings with it some humility. I'm not taking 100% responsibility for your patterns, of course not. But I am taking 100% responsibility for mine. So my suggestion is that there is a little movement that can take us to that humility. And it's very simple, and it's a little old-fashioned. So the first thing is to bring into your consciousness, as you look at your list of patterns that you go into, what's the one, maybe it's the one that you highlighted already, but what's the one that you feel is most painful to your partner? Maybe it's the one you just shared in the group. And so take a moment and put yourself in your partner's shoes and think what it is like, or maybe even think of times when other people have been like that with you. And find a little humility. Just, this is something to say sorry for. And that's something to communicate. The first thing perhaps to say is, I notice that I am in power struggle with you, or I notice that I'm in a bit of a ding-dong with you. You find your own more natural language. The second thing is, I owe you an apology. There's lots that's driving me crazy about you, but I'm not dwelling on that right now. I owe you an apology. I have been a bit, you know, for me, I would be a bit withheld. I've been a bit absent. I've been a bit spaced out. I've been withholding. And I'm sorry. Now, it has to be authentic. If we do it in a kind of nicey-nicey way, it will take us nowhere at all. It took me about 40 years to recognize the difference between saying something nice and saying something nice that I mean. So I'm a slow learner. Don't be like me. Make sure it's something that you mean. Next thing is also, you'll guess, it's to say thank you for something. So the thing to do is to remember with gratitude what it is that, despite how crazy making your partner has been, what else have they been doing that you have forgotten to appreciate them for because you've been too obsessed with how much of a pain in the butt they've been. So when I reflect on the power struggles I get into with my best beloved, I can forget very often, and I hope she's listening. I can forget very often that she, you know, will relentlessly keep an eye on our youngest. Something I can all too easily do when I get self-important about my work. So I can say a natural, warm-hearted thank you for that. When we clear a transference with ourselves, when we write out a transference with ourselves, this kind of thing becomes a bit more possible. So it comes in that order, write the transference, maybe do a bit of the bashing first, do a quadrant check-in before that, but then go straight in with the sorries and thank yous. Then it may be appropriate to communicate. And the way you might want to communicate could be sharing your quadrinity check-ins. So if you're both Hoffman Process graduates, that's a sweet thing to share. It could be, if you both discern that the tool of transference, which is not an entry-level tool, by the way, don't underestimate that you are initiates. You've done the Hoffman Process. You know stuff that puts you actually in a tiny minority of people on this planet. And it may not be that your partner does. I don't mean to set up some superiority. You're not better than them, of course not. But you may just know stuff that they don't know. So it may or may not be appropriate. But if it is, then the way to approach that is to say, can I share something with you? And then also be sure to say, and I'm sorry for this, where it's appropriate. And thank you for that, where it's appropriate. And then invite them to share one back with you. And you could show them the model if they don't know it. But if they do, they can show one back. But the key thing to say is, are you available to help me clear something up? And they get to answer that honestly. They can say no, and they can say yes. And if it's really important, you can say, and they say no, you can say, is there a better time? And if they still say no, then you can say, well, just let me know because this is important to me. Let me know if that changes. And then you leave it. Then you leave it be. So sharing quadrinity check-ins, sharing and clearing transferences can be useful. Got my eye on the time. And so I think it's very important that we use a tool collectively. I'm quite excited about this because I normally work with recycling, which is what we're going to do with groups of about 24, sometimes only a little bit more. And in a Hoffman Process or a Q2 or a retreat setting, that's very lovely working as a group. We've got just a little under 10 Hoffman Processes gathered together today. So our collective energy could be something to behold. It could be something pretty, pretty lovely. Rituals, and this in a way, when we come together to do this kind of work, is a ritual in a way. And rituals are only powerful, not because of the number of candles we light or the fact that it's a full moon, which it is. You know, it's not those things. It's the wholehearted, big-heartedness of the people who are doing it. And when big-hearted, wholehearted people come together as a big group, then something rather magical is possible. And we are a big group of wholehearted people, so here we go. We're going to do the recycling. The recycling is of the pattern that you drew the circle around a little bit earlier. Because after all, less is more. By that I mean, we simply do not have to deal with all our patterns to have a happy life. We simply do not have to have no patterns in order to have a good relationship. I'll say that again. You do not have to deal with all your patterns to have a happy life and relationship. But what we do find is we experience incredibly high levels of intimacy, trust, reward, satisfaction, love, when we shift our consciousness 1%, 2%, we get really big results. So get excited a moment, because supposing that nothing out of the, as a result of this 90 minutes we've shared together, that nothing else changed other than we've had kind of a sweet Zoom experience. But the only thing changed was that one pattern was just not such a big deal for you. Would you regard this 90 minutes as a success? You can do the thumbs up here if you want. It would be good, wouldn't it? That would be worthwhile. Have I got the buy-in? Great, good. Close your eyes and we shall do some recycling. Close your eyes. Take a big and conscious breath. And now take yourself back to the memory that you used in your transference model. Shouldn't take too long because you were just there a moment ago. Really re-experience it. Even if it's painful, even if it's distressing. As if it's now. Feel the feelings. Where are they in your body? Where are you holding those feelings in your body? Think the thoughts. Dark side thoughts, aren't they? You always, you never, I always, I never. Absolutist, rigid thoughts. And notice how that combination of thoughts and feelings is informing your behavior. See yourself acting out those patterns. See the whole vicious cycle unfolding. Feel yourself contract. And if you can, if you feel able to, get into a body posture that somehow dramatizes or exaggerates that pattern experience. A real contraction, tighten your body, clench your fists, whatever's going on for you. Feel the powerlessness of that pattern in your body. Now trust the first impulse that comes to you. Where in your body do you feel it most? Where is the epicenter of this particular volcano, this earthquake? Put a hand there. Just trust that you've got the right place. Don't even overthink it. Just place a hand where in your body that pattern is. And you can say this out loud. You're on mute, but say it out loud. If it had a color, what color would it be? It would be, yeah, just accept it, no matter what it is. See it there in your body, in that color. If it had a texture or a shape, what texture or shape would it be? Get a hand around it, really feel it, and hold the other hand out, palm up. So one hand holding the pattern in your body, the other hand palm up. And then all together, on the count of three, we're going to rip that pattern out of our body, slap it into our hand, and we're going to start to get to work on it. So one, two, three, slap it into your hand. And now what we need is some heat and pressure. And you'll remember from your school days that energy cannot be created or destroyed, but it can be transformed. And we use the word recycled. It can be recycled from an energy. That's all it is. It's a pattern that is energy. You're going to have to mean it, though. So no, don't just sit there passively. Really hard and really fast. We want some heat and we want some power. And we have some intention. We've got to get our give a shit pants on here. We've got to really mean it. So getting it hot. Is it hot? Are you aching? Are your shoulders and muscles aching a little bit? Good. One, two, three. Keep your eyes closed. Hold your hands a few centimeters, inches apart. And hold this extraordinary energy ball in your hands. Move your hands around the energy ball. Feel the zappy power of it. You've done something great here. You've transformed that energy for something that really wasn't serving you anymore. to something that's fit for who you are now, fit for purpose. Hold it up to eye level, still with your eyes closed, and look right into this extraordinary ball of zappy energy. Now, any second now, on the count of three, you're going to get a message. It could be a color, a shape, a song, could be a series of words. It could be anything, but it's something that's going to encourage you and touch your heart. It's the first thing you think of right now. So just take it, trust it, whatever it is. And have that thought or word bubbling around, whether it makes sense or not. And take the energy ball and feed it back and massage it back into your body where you took it out. So as if you were like a little child saying, you know, mommy, I'm hurting, rub it better for me. You rub it better. Put some love from your big heart down through your arm into your hand and then feed that love and that energy ball into your body so that you can breathe that healing energy right down to your toes, breathe it up through your feet, your calves, your shins, your thighs, your sexual organs, your hips, breathe it into your belly, breathe it into your chest, and as you do, throw your shoulders back, breathe it up into your face, your head. Whew. And as you do, activate your spiritual self. You don't have to be good. You don't have to be clever. But breathe that energy, that life force through your body. Reconnect to your spiritual self. And revisit the scene of the pattern. And everything that happened before happens again. It's the same events, the same people, the same circumstances, the same triggers, but you are a totally different animal this time. This is you in your spiritual self handling the same circumstances beautifully well. So just enjoy it for a moment. Lie back, as it were, in a really comfy chair and watch this movie of you just on the best form ever. Your heart is open. You're conscious. You have agency. You have choice. This is you choosing how you want to respond. Notice how you're feeling emotionally now. That's different. Notice how your thoughts have changed and have been replaced with affirmations from your spiritual self. I am, I can, I will, I choose, I feel. And notice, perhaps best of all, how differently you are behaving. And anchor that new behavior with a deep and conscious breath. Put your arms around your body, give yourself a hug. And as you hug yourself, just have a thought. What is the quality in you that's enabling this new behavior? What is it that's making it possible? Is it courage? Is it strength? Is it patience? Is it vulnerability? Is it kindness, love, curiosity, listening? Just out loud, even though you've got your mutes on, say, I am, whatever that quality is. I am. I am loving, I am kind, I am patient. I am sweet, I am vulnerable, I am open. Just so that you can hear the words echoing around your own mind and your dear spiritual self can validate you. Your emotional self can be reassured and your intellect can have a little rest. Feel that through your whole body. And if you haven't ready, open your eyes. And just remember that recycling, it's good to do it once, it helps, but it really helps to do it a lot. So why not make a little commitment to recycling that pattern again, perhaps morning and evening, just 2 or 3 minutes for the next week or so. By that, I mean revisit the positive scene. You simply do not have to go through all this each time. Just revisit the positive scene to remember your body memory of having an imagined positive experience under stress. What a sweet thing to spend the last 90 minutes with you guys. Thank you so much. Lots and lots of love. The warmest thank you to you all.
Thank you so much, Matthew.
What a pleasure.
Thank you very, very much. I'm just going to stop the recording now and then just...